KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton is no fan of President Trump and also no fan of Iran. So what does he make of the U.S. strike on Iran's nuclear facilities? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A few months ago, few people knew the state representative for New York's Astoria neighborhood. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Now, Zohran Mamdani is the presumptive Democratic nominee for mayor. We'll hear about how he got there. Also, tips for how to prepare your home for the next heat wave and a new documentary with a behind-the-scenes look at Barbara Walters titled Tell Me Everything. It's Thursday, June 26th. Happy birthday to the former host of All Things Considered. Robert Charles Siegel is 77 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has finished a news conference at the Pentagon. He and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff discussed the U.S. military strikes on three Iranian nuclear sites last weekend. The CIA has released a new report that aligns with President Trump's declaration the main site at Fordo was obliterated. Another intelligence assessment that came to light earlier this week suggested the damage was minimal. Hegseth says that the Trump administration's view is supported by others.
Here's the head of the UN Atomic Energy Agency this morning, Rafael Grossi. U.S. and Israeli strikes caused enormous damage to Iran's nuclear sites.
However, Hegseth said he is unaware of any intelligence that Iran moved uranium out of the sites ahead of the U.S. strikes. At Turkey's eastern border with Iran, people continue to cross into the city of Van. They're not always fleeing a single moment of crisis, but a sense that life at home is no longer sustainable. Reporter Gerçe Saracoğlu has more from Van, Turkey.
Iranians of all ages arrive quietly, carrying what they can, but more often bringing uncertainty than luggage. Ferhat, who is 25, came from Tehran. He only shared his first name out of fear of government retaliation.
I don't know if my house was bombed.
He left behind his parents and a generational divide. His mother still supports Iran's clerical regime, and it won't be enough for him to return home, even if peace holds.
Nothing could make me happier than that. It's really hard to know, because if the war stops, you'll be living under this regime that has been plundering the country's wealth and youth and time and everything.
For now, Ferhat hopes to stay in Istanbul for a few months. For NPR News, Gökçe Saracoğlu in Van, Turkey.
President Trump's budget director, Russell Vogt, is defending the administration's request to claw back more than $9 billion in foreign aid and funding for public media. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports on the next steps in the Senate.
Senators from both parties press vote about the impact the administration's $1 billion cut for public media would have for emergency services and local news, especially in rural states. Chair Susan Collins says she shares the administration's concerns that some content is ideologically biased, but pointed out most of the money goes to local stations.
There are, however, more targeted approaches to addressing that bias at NPR than rescinding all of the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The House narrowly approved the administration's request, and the Senate has until July 18th to vote. If it fails to approve it, the administration must release the funds for the targeted programs. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, The Capitol.
You're listening to NPR News. The National Weather Service says a prolonged and intense heat wave is still hanging around in the Midwest to the Mid-Atlantic. Forecasters say the area feeling it the worst today is centered over the Ohio Valley, but they say the scorching temperatures are expected to subside by the end of the day. Three new albums stormed the Billboard Top 10 chart, but the album at the top of the charts remains immovable. NPR Stephen Thompson reports.
Fresh faces abound on this week's charts. The K-pop group ATEEZ debuts at number 2 with Golden Hour Part 3. The rapper Lil Tecca follows closely behind with Dopamine. My life changed so fast that I don't even recognize myself from last year. And the contemporary Christian singer Brandon Lake hits the top 10 for the first time in his career with King of Hearts. Still, none of them could knock off this summer's chart king. Morgan Wallen's I'm the Problem holds at number one for a fifth straight week. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
A loaded cargo ship that was on fire burning off the Pacific coast of Alaska sank on Monday. It had been burning for 3 weeks. The crew escaped safely, but the ship was carrying thousands of electric vehicles, and it had some 1,800 metric tons of fuel oil. Emergency responders say they've not yet seen evidence of pollution. Coast Guard officials say it is too early to tell if the EV's lithium batteries triggered the fire. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include AG1, introducing AG1 Next Gen, a daily drink with vitamins, minerals, and probiotics to support overall health. Learn more at drinkag1.com/science.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Coming up, we'll ask how much senators are really willing to cut from Medicaid and clean energy subsidies. First, though, what is the right word to describe the results of a U.S. attack on Iran? President Trump has argued with some of his own intelligence community about that. Preliminary U.S. assessments vary and cast doubt on the extent of damage to Iran's uranium enrichment program. Here's NPR's Arzu Rezvani.
A leaked Defense Intelligence Agency assessment says the damage to Iran's nuclear sites was limited and the program was set back just a few months. But members of President Trump's cabinet have come out one by one and echoed the president as he continues saying the U.S. airstrikes wiped out Iran's key nuclear sites. CIA Director John Ratcliffe released a statement saying Iran's program had been, quote, severely damaged, underscoring what President Trump said during a press conference at the NATO summit yesterday.
It was called obliteration. No other military on earth could have done it.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who accompanied Trump to the summit, was adamant about the destruction to Fordo, the most critical enrichment facility built deep inside a mountain.
We dropped 12 of the strongest bombs on the planet right down the hole in two places. Everything underneath that mountain is in bad shape.
In much the same way, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard posted a message on X saying Iran's nuclear sites had been destroyed and rebuilding would, quote, likely take years, not months, as the leaked report asserted with low confidence. Gabbard's post comes just a few months after she appeared before the House Intelligence Committee delivering a very different message.
Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has not authorized the nuclear weapons program that he suspended in 2003.
That assessment is one Trump repeatedly dismissed in the days before he ordered the weekend attack. Beyond the U.S., Israel issued its own findings, saying the Fordo nuclear facility is now inoperable. Iran's foreign ministry acknowledged only that the facilities were badly damaged. Experts say there is another possibility. Iran may have moved its enriched uranium before the airstrikes, raising big questions about its ability to recover its program if it chooses to. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News.
Ambassador John Bolton has been following all of this. He was National Security Advisor in the first Trump administration. He later wrote a memoir sharply critical of Trump and managed to publish it despite the president's effort to block it in court. In that same book, Bolton disclosed that he had advised Trump to launch a strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Ambassador Bolton, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Is the strike the president ordered the other day approximately the strike you wanted once upon a time?
Well, times have changed since I recommended that. These are the targets that we struck were clearly targets that deserved to be struck. The Israelis had done a lot of work on other Iranian nuclear facilities, but ultimately the objective should be to destroy the program.
Do you assume that work is now done?
No, I don't. I mean, I know that obviously there's a big debate about were they obliterated, were they not, so on and so forth. I mean, just this is going to be resolved over time as new information comes in. The best, you know, the most neutral observer we've got at the moment is the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. I don't think anybody on the left or the right would say he's a tool of Donald Trump's. And the term he has used is just today is that the Iranian program has suffered, quote, enormous damage, and said as well that he thought the centrifuges at Fordo were inoperable. That's the opinion of the IAEA Director General. I'm satisfied with that for now.
So it seems that a lot of damage was done and a lot of munitions were dropped. At the same time, I think we've heard from the IAEA and others that Iran had disclosed the existence of some new nuclear facility that wasn't bombed in this attack. And there's the question of whether uranium got away. Do you think they do have the means to do something?
Well, this is the new development is at a place called Pickaxe Mountain, kind of a strange name, but right near Natanz. It had been suspected for a long time, and for years the government of Iran had simply stonewalled the IAEA. This has been their pattern. It's why they are so untrustworthy. Look, the effort to destroy a complex program involves breaking the links in the nuclear fuel cycle at multiple points, so that it is ultimately a project of years to put it back together. That's why I'm happy finally. I've been spending a long time emphasizing the uranium conversion facility at Esfahan that takes uranium as a solid, turns it into a gas chemically so it can go through the centrifuges, and then later takes the gas and makes it into a metal for fuel fabrication or nuclear weapons work. It was a surface facility. It has been destroyed. That's a key link that's broken. It is certainly the case that we can't account for all of the enriched uranium. And that's one reason why I wouldn't have terminated the air campaign as soon as Trump did. I think there was clearly more work to do.
You would have bombed more, you're saying. That's very interesting.
I certainly would have, and I would have kept Iran under very intense surveillance to see what they might be trying to move around. I hope that part, anyway, is still part of the program with both Israel and the United States, that we're watching very closely what the people running the nuclear program are doing.
I want to ask about what some people have seen as a contradiction here. The president ran for office saying he was against starting new wars. He then, early in his term, wanted a deal with Iran over its nuclear program, and then he abruptly joined Israel's war against Iran, which dismayed a lot of his own allies. Do you think, even if you think this was fundamentally the right decision, do you think this process has been conducted in the most rational and responsible way?
Of course not. That's not the way Trump governs. But, you know, we are where we are at this moment, and he kind of zigged into doing the right thing, and he zagged back out by terminating it too early. He'll probably zig and zag for the next 6 or 8 months as well. That's the way he is. He doesn't have a national security strategy, doesn't really even do policy the way we normally understand that.
I have understood him to say both that he would be happy to make a deal with Iran now and that he has no interest in a deal with Iran. Would you have him make some agreement if one was even possible at this point?
No, I don't think there is any deal that the United States would find acceptable with this regime, which is why I've always believed that destroying the nuclear weapons program was an important step. But the only long-term answer to get peace and stability in the Middle East and around the world is to overthrow the Ayatollahs.
which has been short of what the United States has been willing to try. In about 15 seconds, how could this all still go wrong?
Well, it could be that Iran has a big part of its program under a mountain in North Korea. That's something I've worried about for a long time. We don't know the answer to that.
Ambassador Bolton, pleasure talking with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Bolton served as National Security Advisor during the first Trump administration.
Senate Republicans are racing against the clock to pass President Trump's signature domestic policy bill.
Their self-imposed July 4th deadline is just over a week away, and they're struggling to resolve some sticking points in this tax and spending bill. The debate has made their schedule a little bit uncertain.
Yeah, NPR political reporter Elena Moore is following all of this. All right, so the president wants this bill passed as soon as possible. What's stalling that?
Well, so the bill contains a lot of Trump's agenda, like those tax cuts and more money for border security and defense. And senators are united in delivering on all those things. They're divided on how to pay for it. You know, one big issue is over the future of Medicaid, the federal program that provides health coverage for low-income and disabled Americans in partnership with states. And, you know, in particular, there's a proposal on the table that would require states to decrease the amount that they can tax Medicaid providers. And that would in turn affect the formula that calculates how much federal spending a state gets as part of this joint program. And so that could end up saving the government cash. But some senators are not happy with this idea and worry it will particularly hurt rural hospitals. You know, talks to get those senators on board are ongoing. And remember, Republicans can only afford to lose 3 votes in the Senate.
Yeah, and Medicaid is just one of several disagreements.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's also a debate about whether to scrap a bunch of clean energy tax credits that were implemented during former President Joe Biden's administration. You know, fiscal hawks in the Senate want these to go, but others are pushing back and say that immediately taking away some of these investments could cause Americans to lose jobs and face higher prices. And, you know, outside of just policy issues, the Senate is also dealing with procedural issues that come with the budget tool they're using in order to pass this bill on a simple majority vote, which allows them to potentially get the bill through without Democrats. And, you know, that process is slowing things down, too.
Okay. Policy issues, procedural issues, lots of issues, it sounds like. Let's just say for a second that the Senate is able to pass this bill. Then what happens?
Well, then it would go back to the House of Representatives, and they have to vote on it, too. The House narrowly passed its own version of the bill last month. And big picture, these two bills are just not expected to be super different. But when we pull back the curtain, there may be aspects that anger some House Republicans. And that could be a problem for House Speaker Mike Johnson, who has very tight margins in the House. You know, Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen has been trying to work with some House members who have concerns, but he's hoping Republicans can ultimately solve their differences, given they agree on the main parts of this bill.
This is a really good start moving us all in the right direction. But all of us have some concerns with the bill. But that's what happens when, you know, you're negotiating any bill in here and you get 535 opinions.
All right. So how are they going to get past all this before the end of next week?
Well, the president may play a key role in that. He's hosting a big event this afternoon with what the White House calls everyday Americans, like a DoorDash driver who wants to see no tax on tips. And he'll be putting more pressure on Republicans to just get this done.
That's NPR political reporter Elena Moore. Thanks.
Thanks, A.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize winning fashion critic Robin Givhan joins us to discuss her new book, Make It Ours, Crashing the Gates of Culture with Virgil Abloh. She traces the late designer's unconventional path to luxury fashion, how he challenged tradition and opened once-closed doors, and why she believes he may be one of the last of his kind. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. For decades, viewers counted on this TV journalist to bag the biggest interviews.
Good morning. This is Today in Hawaii. This is 2020.
The Barbara Walters Special.
Good evening. I'm Barbara Walters.
And if you were sitting across from her, you pretty much knew you were going to cry. Celebrities, world leaders, Barbara Walters always seemed to find the right question to crack the facade. It all started in the 1950s when she became one of the few women in television news, off screen or on, and she fought one bully after another to get that screen time. Walters retired in 2015 and died 7 years later. Now she's the subject of a new documentary streaming on Hulu. It's called Barbara Walters, Tell Me Everything. Jackie Jesko directed the film. She's a former ABC News producer.
She started out as a writer on NBC's Today Show, and then slowly, I think just through persistence, which is sort of the name of her game, she eventually got the chance to appear on air in these little segments, as she would call them, like fluffy women's pieces. But she had aspirations to do more serious things. So she kind of slowly but surely made her way on air more and more until the day when a man named Frank McGee came to anchor the Today Show, and he was unhappy having her at the desk with him. And so what he did was tell the boss of NBC News, you know, Barbara can't ask a question until I've asked three questions of whoever was being interviewed that day. And so Barbara, instead of, you know, throwing a tantrum about it, she decides she's going to pivot. And she starts going outside of the studio to people's homes, going to their turf and doing these in-depth interviews that actually became her brand.
You know, I think many people might be surprised to hear that, because women as television presenters is kind of the norm now. I think people may forget just what a big deal it was. The network always paired her with a man. And the men never wanted her there.
I mean, she was really, really ostracized. She describes coming over to ABC News, 1976. She gets a very historic opportunity to be the co-anchor of the evening news. And she was paired with a man named Harry Reasoner, who had no interest in being her co-anchor. I think he was very offended by that.
Well, he didn't want any co-anchor, to be fair.
He didn't, but he had a lot of contempt for her.
The decision was to welcome you as I would any respected and competent colleague of any sex, by noting that I've kept time on your stories in mind tonight. You owe me 4 minutes.
He was particularly annoyed about her and not terribly nice to her, and their chemistry was awful on screen. And she describes that as the low point in her career. You know, she had made this big jump, and everybody was talking about how bad the show was, and she felt like her career might be over. And there is an alternate timeline in which maybe that would have been the end of her career, except that, you know, never underestimate Barbara's ability to turn something around.
One of the other things that was really fun about the film is that you have outtakes.
Yes.
Meaning what came before the edited part and what came after the edited part.
What do I call you during this?
Barbara.
Barbara, is that all right?
I hope so.
ABC News Studios gave us almost unfettered access to 50 years of television.
Is everybody in position? You ready to be interrogated?
in those thousands of hours were these little gems.
Don't cut again unless you must.
Just sort of these unguarded moments where she let it drop for a second, stopped being on TV, Barbara Walters, and you can kind of get a glimpse of what she might have been like to be around.
No, please do not interrupt me. I don't care if I'm shiny. I care more about this interview.
What I think you show with these outtakes is that she knew how to control the moment. Like, for example, with Gaddafi, when she's interviewing the former Libyan dictator, Muammar Gaddafi.
So I will ask questions political and about your life.
This is radio, so you can't see this, but she's wearing this like pink Chanel-like suit. And some people thought, oh my gosh, what is she wearing?
And then the producer said, no, she knows exactly what she's doing. That was her battle armor. That was saying, I'm sophisticated, I'm culturally important. And when the cameras go on, I'm in charge in this tent, not you.
In our country, we read that you are unstable. We read that you are mad. You know that those things have been printed. What do you say to that?
And I was wondering, because you're a producer yourself, like, when you saw that, what did you think?
I mean, it was amazing. I can't imagine that she wasn't frightened on some level. You know, at that point in time, Muammar Gaddafi was pretty much the most feared man in the world, right? But I think she knew that she had to project power and confidence to get a man like that to engage with her.
Can you tell us about your childhood, what you hoped to be when you were a little boy?
You can always see her holding this like thick stack of index cards in every one of her interviews. And these were questions that she herself meticulously prepared. I swear every producer that worked for her has PTSD about these index cards and how many hundreds of them that she would write for every single interview and then shuffle them and change the order. Like, she was a perfectionist for sure.
So full disclosure, I worked at ABC News. I never worked with her directly because we worked on different shows, those magazine shows that famously where people didn't speak to each other in the elevator. But one of the things about it that I remember is that people were always passing along words of wisdom from Barbara. Things like, you know, my hair is dark at the time and I had a dark background for one of my stand-ups. And one of the producers said to me, Barbara would never let that happen. Don't do that. People were basically passing on words of wisdom from her. And I found that fascinating. And one of the things that was interesting to me is nobody ever passed on words of wisdom from any other anchor to me.
I mean, that kind of makes sense to me. I feel like everybody sort of at ABC, like, she held a special status that I don't know if has been matched. But, you know, a lot of it maybe is just that she was a person who openly expressed her opinion. That's what a lot of people say about her. And I think that, you know, she just was funny. And so there would be things that she would say and it would really stick with people.
You've interviewed a lot of famous television anchors, especially women, for this. Did you think she was a girl's girl in the sense of, you know how we mean like a girl's girl, mm-hmm. like somebody who really champions other women, wants other women to succeed?
You know, it's interesting because she herself is pretty clear. She's like, you know, I wasn't waving a flag. I wasn't bursting through all of these glass ceilings for all women. She was doing it because she wanted it. But at the same time, I definitely think near the end of her life, especially, she was just so immensely proud of the fact that, you know, she had blazed this trail and so many others had been able to follow her.
That's Jackie Jessica. She's directed the new documentary, Barbara Walters, Tell Me Everything. It's streaming now on Hulu. Jackie Jessica, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
This is NPR News.
It's been 10 years since the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage. Religious support for the right to marry has grown significantly, but there's still substantial opposition from some religious groups.
As you saw with the overturn of Roe, that took 50 years. So we would have to be patient.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he's not aware of any intelligence suggesting Iran was able to move its enriched uranium before the U.S. military struck three Iranian nuclear sites. Hegseth spoke at a Pentagon briefing this morning alongside the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Hegseth was also critical of the media for reporting on a leaked preliminary intelligence report suggesting limited damage. Iran's supreme leader is sounding defiant and criticizing President Trump in the aftermath of the U.S. attacks. NPR's Jane Arraf has more.
Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said the U.S. entered the war to save Israel after Iran proved it could penetrate Israeli air defenses. He said President Trump was exaggerating the impact of American airstrikes on Iran and minimizing the effect of Iran's strikes on a U.S. military base in Qatar. It is a major incident, he said, referring to the Iranian attack on the U.S. base, and this incident can be repeated in the future. Khamenei said Trump's calls for Iran to surrender made clear the U.S. goal was wider than eliminating nuclear sites. He said Iranian civilization was much older and richer than America's, and that Iran would never surrender. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill today, senators are expected to receive a classified briefing about the U.S. airstrikes in Iran. It was pushed back from Tuesday. The federal government is investigating the University of Michigan health system. At issue is the firing of a health care worker who cited religious grounds for declining to perform gender-affirming care. Kate Wells with Michigan Public explains.
Physician assistant Valerie Klosterman says she was fired 4 years ago after she asked for a religious exemption from using transgender patients' preferred pronouns and from referring those patients for gender-affirming care. She filed a discrimination suit, and the health system denies the allegations. But now the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is opening its own investigation. Sam Bagenstos was a department lawyer during the Biden administration.
It's definitely trying to send a message that the Trump administration is going to investigate or otherwise harass providers of gender-affirming care.
The department says it's enforcing federal laws that allow healthcare workers to practice both their profession and their faith. For NPR News, I'm Kate Wells in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Revised numbers from the government show the U.S. economy shrank 0.5% in the first quarter. That's more than first reported. On Wall Street, stocks opened higher moments ago. The Dow's up 171 points. The Nasdaq's up 89. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. A state assemblyman from Queens is now the presumptive Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. And Zoran Mandani did it in a matter of months. Bob Hart is here to tell us more about him. He's longtime political director at New York One. That's a Spectrum news channel in the city. So, Bob, tell us about how he rose so fast.
5 years ago, Mom Donnie was running for the state assembly in a crowded Democratic primary, and no one outside of his Astoria, Queens neighborhood really had heard of him. He made somewhat of an impact in Albany, pushing for free buses in New York City for commuters, but he still was viewed as an outlier in this race, I would say, from 5 months ago, and it was just through social media and hard work and seizing the left lane in the mayor's race that he really rose to prominence and became a Goliath slayer. In the Goliath form was Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, so tell us, you mentioned social media. Tell us about that part of his rise, because some pretty powerful ads apparently did really well on social media. So how much of a factor was that?
He went on the Coney Island plunge into the ocean wearing a full suit. He walked from one end of Manhattan to the other. And while these are gimmicks, he seemed to be real. And it really had an impact with a lot of younger voters. The question I think a lot of people had on primary day was, would the TikTok clicks translate into votes? And obviously, we know the answer now.
Yeah, hopefully that suit wasn't a new suit. I mean, it was an older suit that he didn't need or something. So one thing really quick, because this is the part that fascinates me about this, is that the New York Times and the New York Post, for those that are maybe not from New York or know New York, they don't agree on much. The editorial boards of each paper don't agree on much. But they both agreed that voters in New York should not vote for him.
And it was for different reasons. Obviously, those two papers are from different ideological spectrums. For the New York Post, Mamdani was just too far to liberal. For the New York Times, they thought that Mamdani just didn't have enough experience. And so you almost had a unanimous opinion with the New York political elite that Mamdani wasn't ready for prime time. The voters thought otherwise.
Yeah. So, okay. So Mamdani's platform includes a rent freeze, free buses, childcare. Now, so assuming he wins, what would determine whether he can actually make the changes that he's promising? I mean, how would it be paid for?
That's the $64 question, or actually a much higher price. The governor and the state legislature in Albany hold the reins of power in New York City. No matter who's the governor or who the legislature is or who's the mayor, the way the state government is structured in New York is that it has to go through Albany. And that's going to be a rocky road for Mamdani, because Governor Hochul, even though she's a Democrat, doesn't want to raise taxes, which is part of Mamdani's proposals, and she's up for re-election next year. So you can already see a tricky path for Mamdani should he become elected mayor. And we should point out, even though New York City is heavily Democratic, there's still a general election in November.
Yeah, all right, so it's only been a few days, but what sort of early opposition are you seeing against Mamdani's general election campaign?
So there could be as many as four opponents that Mamdani's facing, including Andrew Cuomo, who has not said whether or not he's going to continue his run. He has an independent line should he pursue it. We haven't talked at all about the Democratic incumbent mayor, Eric Adams, who will also be running on a third-party line as well. And then you have Republican Curtis Sliwa, who created the subway safety group, the Guardian Angels. And you could create a scenario with all of these different candidates where a Republican like Sliwa could somehow slip in because of a divided electoral math. And the same thing with Mayor Adams.
What do you think his success says about politics in New York City, at least for now?
I think it shows that there's a real hunger from the younger generation of new leadership, that there is still political excitement. People aren't just jaded and cynical people in their 20s and 30s, but they want something new. Andrew Cuomo would have been the oldest mayor sworn in New York City in history. And Mamdani, if he wins, will be the youngest in more than 100 years.
All right. That's Bob Hart of New York One. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. One of the times I went running this week, in our nation's capital, it was early in the morning, but already 82 degrees and 82% humidity. Washington, D.C. has had daytime temperatures over 100 this week, rainforest-style rainstorms, and this is not exceptional across the Midwest and East Coast. Boston has been over 90. It was over 100 in Indiana, where my mom luckily just got her AC fixed. We may need to prepare for more heat waves like this. From the Climate Desk, NPR's Julia Simon has some advice on what to do.
Let's start with our homes. If you're getting ready for the next heat wave, Daniel Barber, architectural theory professor at Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands, says to think about sunshine coming in through your windows.
The sunlight that's coming in, bringing in light, is also bringing in heat.
That's why he says people should consider shades on the outside of the window, going down vertically. It's called external shading. That can keep out the sun and the heat. Another tip comes from Dorit Aviv, professor of architecture at the University of Pennsylvania. She says to prepare for increased heat, think about your roof.
The roof is usually exposed directly to the sun, so it's where we get the most solar radiation.
Many roofs are made of dark-colored materials, which absorb even more heat. All that rooftop heat then gets absorbed into your home. That's why Aviv suggests coating your roof with a white or silvery color, a reflective roof.
We're literally reflecting that heat back into the atmosphere instead of letting it go into our house.
For Americans without air conditioning or who don't like to rent it because it's too expensive, figure out where your local community cooling shelter is. Michael Mendez, an environmental policy professor at the University of California, Irvine, says another way to prepare for more heat waves is by thinking about shade. He says communities are planting more trees to cool urban areas down.
That's been a strategy that many cities around the world, including Paris, have done.
Another heat wave solution, Mendez says, is to increase solar energy plus large-scale batteries. It reduces the use of planet-heating fossil fuels, and it reduces stress on the antiquated electric grid, which can break down during heat waves when people need air conditioning most.
By moving to more renewable energies and also storing it through batteries, we can ensure that all parts of the communities have access to affordable energy options during these extreme heat days.
And in this heat wave and future ones, experts say to check in on your neighbors, particularly if they're older, to make sure they're okay. Julia Simon, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration is rolling back the roadless rule, a Clinton-era policy that prevented roads and logging on millions of acres of federal land. Next time on Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good Good morning, me Martinez. Last night, the Dallas Mavericks made Duke University's Cooper Flagg the first overall pick in the NBA draft. He's only 18 years old, the youngest number one draft pick since LeBron James. Now, to make that happen, Flagg had to graduate from high school early. He was asked before the draft why he made that decision, and Flagg quoted his mom, who had the most baller advice for her son: if you're the best player in the gym, then you need to find a new gym. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. States hold all sorts of personal information about residents, and the Trump administration is eager to get access to large chunks of it. Here to explain why, we're joined by NPR's Jude Joffe Block, who has been covering this issue. So what sort of data is the federal government asking states to hand over?
Well, to set the stage here, there's been a massive effort over the last few months led by the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, to amass and consolidate personal data from different corners of the government in ways never done before. And now we're seeing that effort extend to data typically held by states. Two big examples of this are Medicaid and federal food assistance, known as SNAP. States administer these programs with federal funds, and in the case of SNAP, states typically held on to this personal data of the people who enrolled. But last month, the Department of Agriculture told states they would soon have to share sensitive data on everyone who'd applied for the program over the last 5 years. We're talking tens of millions of people's names, addresses, social security numbers, and birthdays.
Why did the Trump administration want to consolidate this kind of data?
Well, the Trump administration is arguing that the data collection and analysis is key to the goal of rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse. And this quickly gets linked to immigration because there's a lot of rhetoric about the need to stop immigrants without legal status from receiving federal benefits they're not entitled to. We haven't seen a lot of evidence of that kind of fraud as a widespread issue, but Trump has signed an executive order to ensure it's not happening. He's also signed another one on data sharing that calls for federal agencies to have unfettered access to data from state programs that receive federal funds, including from third-party contractors. And all this data can be useful for the administration's immigration enforcement goals, because in some cases, states have data for tracking people the federal government might not have, like current addresses.
You know, if I were to guess, I would think that the federal government and the states share information all the time. So what's the issue here?
Well, there's some legal questions. So federal privacy laws, like the Privacy Act, were designed to ensure that when the federal government collects personal data on Americans, it can only be used for a specific purpose, and there are limits on disclosing it. But that's really being tested by this administration. So for example, states routinely share detailed data on Medicaid enrollees with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare systems. But until now, states thought that it would be kept confidential. Instead, the AP reported earlier this month that top health officials ordered Medicaid data from a handful of states to be turned over to the Department of Homeland Security, which of course oversees immigration enforcement.
So what do privacy experts think about all this?
Well, privacy advocates are calling on states to protect state data. They point out that some states have their own state laws that prevent certain kinds of data sharing. We spoke with Nicole Schneidman with the nonprofit legal group Protect Democracy. Her message is that once data is collected and aggregated, it could be used for all kinds of broad surveillance purposes against all Americans.
There is precedent, maybe not in this country, but certainly in other countries, around using this kind of data to quash dissent at scale.
And we asked the White House about this critique. Spokesperson Taylor Rogers dismissed critics as being biased. He told us, quote, "President Trump is streamlining data collection across all agencies to increase government efficiency and save hard-earned taxpayer dollars," and said the administration is committed to protecting the privacy of Americans.
All right, that's NPR's Jude Joffe Block, and you can read more of her reporting about the Trump administration's efforts to get a hold of state data at npr.org. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Closing arguments are set to begin today in the trial of Sean Combs. The hip-hop mogul faces charges including sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. He's pleaded not guilty, but if convicted on all counts, Combs could spend the rest of his life in prison. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has been covering the trial. She joins us now to bring us up to speed. And a warning, we will be mentioning violent acts and alleged sex trafficking. So, Isabella, seventh week of the trial, where do things stand?
So the last thing that happened in the trial was the defense rested its case in under 30 minutes. The government, on the other hand, called more than two dozen witnesses over the course of 6 weeks. Two of those witnesses were ex-girlfriends who accused Combs of sex trafficking. The singer Cassie Ventura, and another woman who testified using the pseudonym Jane to protect her identity. Both of them testified that Combs pressured them into drug-fueled sexual encounters with male escorts. They both said that there were moments of domestic violence in the relationships. But the charges against Combs are more complex than simply the abuse they're accusing him of. For example, one of the charges he faces, like you mentioned, is for racketeering conspiracy. So there were lots of other witnesses that included employees, law enforcement agents, and some of those escorts. What the prosecution is trying to depict with all of this testimony and evidence is an entire criminal enterprise. I spoke to Jennifer Beidle. She's a former prosecutor in the same district that Combs is being tried in, and she says it's just hard to know what the jury's thinking.
As a prosecutor, you think through, I'm going to lay this out in this super compelling way, and then you have no way of knowing whether the jury was in any way persuaded by that thought process.
Now, the government's closing arguments start today, actually. So what's the big picture? I mean, what picture are they going to try and paint for those jurors?
Well, you know, they spent a month and a half mapping out a constellation of characters, crimes, and evidence to build their story. Those crimes include kidnapping, arson, and even forced labor. So proving the racketeering charge requires prosecutors to convince the jury not only that Combs abused Ventura and Jane, but that he used his businesses to silence these women. The prosecution has described all of these elements, and now they have to explain how all of the pieces fit together.
Now, you mentioned the defense's case took, what, less than 30 minutes. What do you expect they're going to say during their closing arguments?
I mean, the defense has said from the very beginning that Combs is a complicated guy. His own lawyers have said, yeah, he was violent, he was not always a good boss. But in some ways, they'd have a more straightforward job, which is simply to argue that whatever bad things he may have done don't add up to trafficking, and that all of this messy personal stuff was very separate from his legitimate companies. Jennifer Beidle says we're likely going to see the defense double down on the idea that the government might be overcharging Combs.
I do think it's smart for the defense to have accepted that some bad conduct happened here. They're not trying to run away from things that have obviously been proven and that might very well be state court crimes.
So the point the defense is likely going to highlight is, does this all rise to the level of the federal crimes Combs is being charged with?
Quickly, Isabella, what's the timeline here?
So prosecution closing arguments will start today. The defense will do the same thing tomorrow. Then the jury will start deliberating, and we just have to wait for them to land on a verdict.
All right, that's NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Some other news now. The Trump administration is considering whether to permit a mining project at the bottom of the Pacific. The plan involves a new way of extracting minerals used in defense and energy technologies. Daniel Ackerman reports on the company behind it and the questions the project is raising.
The idea for deep sea mining has been around for a while. Take it from this very 1980s documentary.
The Sea, a new reserve of global resources.
That's an educational film by Allegro Productions. The ocean floor holds a lot of metal. That includes nickel and cobalt used in technology like electric cars. And those metals are bound up in these strange-looking rocks called polymetallic nodules.
Potato-sized objects covering thousands of square miles of sea bottom.
But those potato-sized nodules have never been mined. Now, a startup called The Metals Company wants to be the first. CEO Jared Barron says those nodules are just waiting.
They literally sit there like golf balls on a driving range. We can pick those nodules up and turn them into metals at a fraction of the environmental and human impacts compared to land-based mining.
Barron is a serial entrepreneur from Australia. He's done everything from software to manufacturing to finance, but since he became head of The Metals Company in 2017, Barron has been laser-focused on deep-sea mining. His firm has developed technology, something like a giant remote-controlled vacuum cleaner, to suck up nodules off the seabed. It wants to use that vacuum in a remote patch of the Pacific Ocean. He says mining there means you don't have to clear-cut a rainforest or displace communities like you might on land.
This is the perfect place. There's no alternative for this part of the seafloor. You can't grow crops there. People can't live there. It's perfect.
But not everyone agrees. Cheryl Murdoch is an oceanographer at Arizona State University. She says mining beneath miles of seawater would just hide the impacts.
On land, we all see how destructive mining is. But on the seafloor, no one's going to see it. So I don't think it's going to be less destructive. It's that people are going to be less aware of it.
Some analysts have also questioned the business case for deep sea mining. Many EV car makers have shifted away from using nickel and cobalt. And right now, there's a global oversupply of those metals. Even some terrestrial mines are going idle. But Dan Ives, a tech analyst at Wedbush Securities, says the outlook for deep sea mining improved this past April with a stroke of Donald Trump's pen.
I'd say the industry got a lifeline with the Trump executive order. That's what changed everything.
The order called on the U.S. government to fast-track deep-sea mining in both federal and international waters. And that puts the U.S. at odds with nearly every other country on Earth.
The area is an international possession.
Leticia Carvalho is Secretary General of the International Seabed Authority. That's the body recognized by more than 160 countries that regulates the deep-sea beyond national control, including the part of the Pacific where the metals company wants to mine. Carvalho says those minerals belong to all humans.
Therefore, any activity without an authorization of the International Seabed Authority constitutes a violation of the international law.
But the Trump administration says it's not bound by that law. The U.S. never ratified the underlying treaty. And Trump says the U.S. needs its own supply of critical minerals because global supplies are now dominated by China. Barron plans to seize this new political opportunity. He says the metals company is ready to start mining nodules while Trump is still in office, even though other countries say they're not America's minerals to mine. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Ackerman.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Bye.